The second case of the day, Benuzzi versus the Board of Education. Ms. Siegel.
May it please the Court. My name is Elaine Siegel, and I represent the plaintiff appellant, Jessica Benuzzi. We're here on an appeal from the grant of summary judgment by the trial court on claims of discrimination and retaliation under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And I'd like to point out to the court that it is undisputed that in each instance of the many circumstances that arose in the course of Ms. Benuzzi's employment, she was at Pershing School, she disputed the account that was given by the principal of her supposed misconduct. The trial court noted that Ms. Benuzzi had denied each one of those instances, and that she had an alternative explanation as to what it was that happened.
But why does that matter? I mean, to take the one, for example, dealing with the student, it's uncontested that Principal Watkins had in front of her the note from the student, which is in the record, giving the student's account of what was said. And we don't sit to be a second-line adjudicator of these things. We just ask whether the decision-maker, here the principal, I'll assume, was basing the decision on something, you know, that was a non-discriminatory thing, or was there any reason to suspect discrimination? And so whether or not this happened, whether the student was accurately reporting, is really not the question before us. It's could Principal Watkins, you know, what was in front of her? What did she think?
Well, I understand, and I think that that's a good example, because what the trial court overlooked and what the board does not address is the fact that Principal Watkins was standing right there. The principal was there and had some independent knowledge of what was said by the various parties.
But you're still asking us to go back inside her head and decide whether she should have credited the student's account or Ms. Benuzzi's account. And I don't think that's what our law says at all.
Now, I think in that particular instance, the inference arises that the principal, who was in a position of strong authority over the student and who knew what was said, exerted her authority, exerted her power over that student, and we have Ms. Benuzzi, who is saying that she didn't say that. That creates a fact issue. It's an issue of material fact as to whether the principal could have had a good faith belief, which is what the trial court clung to, a good faith belief that that actually occurred.
But why is it, why? I mean, that's pretty speculative. I mean, you have a few steps in there that, you know, how close was the principal, and did she say something to the student, and did she lean on the student, and this and that. We have no evidence that anything like that happened. We have the note.
We have evidence that she was there. We have evidence that places her right in that corridor, right there where the student was sitting, and that Ms. Benuzzi makes a statement, a very credible statement, as to what it was that she said to the student apologizing. Similarly, we have a complete dispute in the course of the conversation between Ms. Benuzzi herself and the principal as to what it was each one of them said in the course of that conversation. So those are conflicts that cannot be resolved at the summary judgment stage. And, of course, that's one of a very large sequence of things that occurred.
Well, but, I mean, we need to focus on that as well. The district court found that there were really only three adverse employment actions, the three suspensions, and everything else under this court's law doesn't count as that. You know, we've tried not to hamper employers by saying every time you have a supervisor speaking, you know, in a disciplinary way to somebody, you know, you've got to change your tone or whatever. That people couldn't run workplaces that way. So the only concrete things that happened were these three 15-day suspensions.
Well, I think that misreads the law, because for one thing, we have two claims, and they're very different.
Well,
one is a retaliation.
Be specific about what else you think does count as an adverse employment action.
Well, let's take it under the context of retaliation. In the context of retaliation, we have a course of conduct that started off not long after the first EEOC charge was filed, up through after litigation was commenced.
But you didn't file any supplemental pleading to bring in the post-filing conduct, did you?
That's all encompassed within the EEOC. The continuing retaliation is encompassed within the investigation if it's logically connected with that. So the fact that it continued, the fact that the retaliation continued after the litigation was filed is germane in and of itself. Now, on June...
You know, it seems like the course of conduct began the moment they met.
It does.
The principal's visit, even before the school reopened, there was friction there about the rings and so on and so forth. It's just hard to distinguish their relationship from what you contend are retaliatory events.
Well, I believe that if you look at what happened, the specific timing of the incidents that happened once the litigation was commenced, and this case was filed on June 9th of 2009, and Watkins waived service on June 18th. And then on the 23rd of June, she was ready to remove her from the school. She arranged for Ms. Benuzzi's removal from the school at a transfer to an inferior position, and to eliminate her from her job. She would have been in a lower-paying position as a substitute with substantially lower responsibilities.
But, of course, that doesn't happen, right?
No, that doesn't happen.
That doesn't happen.
Somebody steps in and says...
What's our law about things that are threatened but don't happen?
Well, we have the recent decision of this court... give me a moment, I'll give you the exact citation, where this court, a 2010 decision, determined that actually a singular incident of a threat of termination is sufficient to constitute an adverse employment action. Now, the day after Ms. Benuzzi gave her deposition testimony, once again she was served with disciplinary action that was up to and including the possible threat of termination. So that happened the day after her deposition, and then the day before the deposition of a material witness, she gave him a cautionary notice.
Well, I mean, I guess, following up on what Judge Tinder said, I mean, if you look at this record as a whole, it's very hard to see how the school district was engaged in pretext when you have such a long record of tension, if you will, all the way back to September 16, 2005, a cautionary notice or a tone of voice, another cautionary notice in February of 06, screaming incidents in 06, suspensions, difficulties with other employees. You know, the school district, those aren't gender-related problems. They could happen to anybody of any gender.
Well, I think that it's important, you know, again, getting back to the post-litigation phase of things, that if Ms. Watkins had a good faith belief that there was a legitimate reason to be transferring Ms. Benuzzi out of her school and removing her out of a fear of her personal safety, when she was testifying under oath at her deposition, why wasn't she straightforward about that? She contended that she didn't do it until she was actually confronted with the document that had her own words as she sought to remove Ms. Benuzzi from the school. How could she have a good faith belief? How could she have forgotten that in the few months that elapsed between the time of the filing of the complaint in this hotly contested case when she sat for deposition and was testifying under oath? At that point, it is clearly an issue, whether or not without regard
to... The general tenor of her deposition is that this has been a problem employee. I mean, getting away from whether she remembers one particular thought she had, the theme of a problem employee runs throughout.
Well, the theme of a problem employee runs throughout, and it's something that started, as the judge points out, as soon as the two of them met each other.
Well, and in fact, her discipline problems, Benuzzi's preceded this principal, didn't they? Didn't she have almost a continual history at that at various schools.
This is a situation where we had moved the trial court to strike that aspect of the defense. The trial court did not look at her prior discipline, and we have a fundamental logical contradiction if you look at her prior employment. Ms. Vannuzzi disputes all of that. There's deposition testimony that contradicts the testimony of her prior principal. And, of course, these things are in the personnel file. So if somebody wants to create a, you know, contrive a situation, then they can just pull that out. And, in fact, what we see happening with Ms. Watkins is that she tried to set up Ms. Vannuzzi and make it appear that Ms. Vannuzzi was erratic and dangerous and needed to be removed from the school. I have...
May I ask you a question that may go back to what the district court considered? And I'm not clear at all on this 56.1 issue of what material facts, which clearly are contained, some material facts appears to be contained in your supplemental, which was disregarded by the district court. And neither party, it seems to me, is focused on what exactly the district court considered here. Because she struck substantial parts, it seems to me, or disregarded of that supplemental facts, some of which I think you're arguing this morning.
Well, we don't know because the trial court.
That's exactly right.
The trial court didn't identify what was considered.
Yeah, nor have either of the parties attempted to analyze, if they can, what she has relied upon.
Truly, I couldn't determine from reading that that skeletal opinion. And I will say that what
so
was.
So is there anything in that supplemental your statement of additional facts under 56.1 that we should consider?
I think it should be considered in its entirety.
Well, how can we do that with a ruling by the district court, which is disregarded? She says, without specificity, perhaps she's disregarded it. How are we to be aided in analyzing what was considered below?
Well, this is a summary judgment decision is reviewed de novo by this court.
So I guess I want to know
what's in the record.
What material facts or alleged material facts which would aid your position are there to be considered?
How
do we know?
Well, one thing that I think that that needs to be considered that is absent from the record and that I've been discussing since I began is all the post-litigation conduct. That constitutes a continuing course of retaliation from the time the EEOC was charged. And the trial
court...
Well,
that wouldn't help on your gender discrimination claim.
No.
That's really focused on only the retaliation claim.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And with respect to that, as the trial court acknowledged, and it makes it very difficult to determine what the trial court was looking at and not looking at, the trial court acknowledged that every incident was disputed by the plaintiff, which would indicate that everything in our fact record was something that the trial court had looked at and recognized that there were disputes of fact about each incident.
That's included in your client's response to the Rule 56.1 submission of your opponents, right?
Yes, sir.
The denials are.
The denials are there, and then we have statements of additional fact, and they're supported by very substantial evidence. There's a great deal of documentary evidence and a great deal of testimonial evidence that we submitted to the court.
Well, what are we to make of her decision, the district court's decision, there's not a compliance because of the nature of the response, that they were too expansive? And
well, the trial court says at the very same time not only that it's expansive, but that it's a very fact-specific, complex case. We had, I think, that the maximum number of lines in our responses was something like 18 lines. And I would submit to the court that where those paraphrases were required by the rules to paraphrase the evidence that we're citing, and given the numerous incidents on which the principal was relying, it seems to me that we had an obligation. We're kind of caught in a conundrum here. We had an obligation to recite that.
But that's not before us, is it? I mean, her ruling is before us, but what she has not considered is not before us, right? In the supplemental filing.
No, I believe that it is. I believe that that's something else to be... I see no law that would prevent this court from reviewing those statements and that evidence de novo. I see nothing in the rulings.
But a ruling on a 56-1 by a district court is given great deference by this court. I mean, how each district judge plays that out. Now you can say there was an abuse of discretion here. I
believe that it was an abuse of discretion. I believe that we stated very concisely, that we paraphrased concisely the numerous pieces of evidence that contradicted the testimony and the evidence that was put in issue by the board. And I find it very difficult to consider how we may have done it otherwise. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Mr. Trent.
May it please the court, my name is Mark Trent. I appear on behalf of the Board of Education of the City of Chicago. Your Honors, the district court noted in a footnotes to its decision that, and I quote, as with all the accusations lodged against her, Benuzzi denies doing anything wrong. She does not deny the accusations were made. And I think that's a thread that runs throughout this whole case. And I'll pick up on what Ms. Siegel was saying regarding the incident involving the report by the student. Ms. Siegel.
But before you go there, I was also disturbed by the point that Judge Flom has raised. As is often the case, I mean, here we do have an abuse of discretion standard with respect to a district court's decision either to enforce 56.1 strictly or a little more leniently, but there has to be some clue in the facts as to which things the district court chose to accept as properly before it and which things not, and then usually you expect the other side to say, you know, we were prejudiced because you didn't consider paragraph 33 or whatever they want to say. But here, everybody's groping around in the dark, and it seems to me we're almost compelled to look at everything in the plaintiff's Rule 56.1 statement because we have no idea what was excluded. I mean, I've looked and looked at this, and I just can't pull out from it any specificity.
Your Honor, I would actually agree with that everything in the record is available to this court for review.
So you would agree that we can, in a sense, disregard what the district court said about 56.1 and just look at everything she put in.
Under the circumstances, I believe so.
Mr. Trent, you didn't, or your client did not move to strike the plaintiff's 56.1 submission. Is that right?
No,
the court did that on the court's own, right?
That's correct. Motions to strike 56.1 statements are not favored by many of the district judges. And I think the problem we have here is that we're putting the district judges in a very difficult position because what happened in this 56.1 statement was that we had lengthy paragraphs about incidents that occurred where Ms. Benuzzi was disputing allegations made by third parties. The district court, while finding that some of it may be relevant, reaches a point where it's put in the position that it would have to strike portions of paragraphs. And I don't think that when someone sets forth or gives a 56.1 statement to the court that they should put the district and the court in the position of going through each paragraph and coming with an opinion on which sentences are relevant and which are extraneous. And so I think in this case I would agree that since this is a de novo review, anything that the appellants wanted to put in the briefs and present to this court as evidence, they could have done so. And I think that based upon the briefs that they submitted, they simply hadn't done it enough or set forth any additional facts which would warrant the lower court decision being overturned. Where we get into the dispute with respect to the factual basis of the allegations is that Ms. Siegel asserted that it is undisputed that in this case that every account or version of the facts given by the principal is disputed by Ms. Benuzzi. That is not the case, because the principal is not the one disputing the accounts given by Ms. Benuzzi. The disputes are between the information obtained by the third parties and reported to the principal and Ms. Benuzzi. That's where the disputes lie.
Now, wait a minute. What about the cell phone call situation where principal says that she was hung up on and Benuzzi says the phone died or she thought the conversation didn't end or something like that? That's one-on-one.
That is a case where the principal would have personal knowledge. And I think the issue in that instance comes down to whether or not she had a reasonable basis for believing that she was hung up on. Actually, Ms. Benuzzi's testimony in that regard was inconsistent. In one instance, she says that she hung up the phone because she thought that the conversation had ended. In another instance, she claims that the phone became that the connection was lost. And I think, regardless of which version of Ms. Benuzzi you accept, it's still reasonable to believe that when the principal is having a conversation and all of a sudden the line goes dead, that there's a factual basis for her to believe that Ms. Benuzzi hung up the phone, especially when they're involved in a heated argument. So I think that with respect to most of the incidents that led to the disciplinary actions were based on information that came from third parties. Ms. Siegel claimed that the principal, Ms. Watkins, had knowledge of what the student said, what Ms. Benuzzi said to the student.
Yeah,
there is no evidence of that. What happened was there was an argument in the hallway where the student was present or within earshot, and both Ms. Benuzzi and Ms. Watkins were present. And then after the argument ceased, then Ms. Benuzzi went and had a conversation with the student. She disputes the student's account of what was said, but the student then later went and reported it to the principal. So there's no evidence that Ms. Watkins overheard specifically what was said. She was taking her actions based solely upon what was reported by the student. And that's essentially what a theme that runs through all of these, because
just to clarify that, I guess I don't want to put words in your mouth. I just want to understand your argument. Your position would be that even if the record shows that Ms. Benuzzi and Principal Watkins were standing together in the hall arguing initially, that by the time Ms. Benuzzi goes over to the student, the record is silent about whether Watkins stayed there or walked off or did anything else. Is that your understanding of the facts?
That's my understanding of the facts. There's no evidence that Ms. Watkins specifically overheard the conversation between Ms. Benuzzi and the student. With respect to the claims of adverse action and retaliation, as the court noted, this history of a dispute started from almost the day they met and went on for a long period of time before we even reach the point where there's any suggestion of protected activity by Ms. Benuzzi. In fact, the first 15-day suspension, there were actually two cautionary notices and a 15-day suspension before the first charge of discrimination is even filed. I would note that in all there were four charges of discrimination filed by Ms. Benuzzi. And with respect to the timing issue, which Ms. Benuzzi seems to be relying on, it should be noted that two of the suspensions, two of the charges were filed just prior to a year in which there was no disciplinary action against Ms. Benuzzi, and she got an outstanding performance rating.
But, you know, I mean, I have to say that the timing after the deposition looks terrible for the school district. And she gives her deposition, and then you know, practically by return email, you know, she winds up getting called up on disciplinary hearings. That's a very close.
Your Honor, if I could address that, the timing of these incidents were not driven by Ms. Watkins. What happened was the depositions were scheduled to be taken, and shortly before the depositions were scheduled to be taken, Ms. Benuzzi reported that she had had a physical confrontation with a coworker. Ms. Benuzzi reports this to Ms. Watkins and says, you're going to be getting a call because I'm afraid that he's going to report this and blame...
Is it in the office about whether she's pushing him?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And so this occurs within a couple of weeks of when the deposition is to occur. Later on, sure enough, the coworker comes and reports the same thing to Ms. Watkins, blaming it on Ms. Benuzzi. So Ms. Siegel, in her argument previously, said tried to claim that the principal was not only retaliating against Ms. Benuzzi, but it was also trying to threaten the coworker who was also to be deposed in the case. Now, if you put yourself in Ms. Watkins' situation, she has Ms. Benuzzi reporting that she was physically assaulted by a coworker. She therefore is of the mind that she is going to take action against the coworker. Then the coworker comes and says that she was assaulted or that he was assaulted by Ms. Benuzzi. And now,
when the notice goes out about that after the deposition, day after the deposition, it reaches back over a year, I think, of other incidents, including other incidents, all wrapped up in the same notice. It's a little suspicious.
It does, Your Honor. I don't think it's suspicious. I think basically what the situation, obviously these whole things had been an ongoing problem. And there was an allegation that Ms. Benuzzi falsely told Ms. Watkins that the key couldn't be turned on a couple of months before. There was an allegation that Ms. Benuzzi failed to answer a walkie-talkie. Each of those things in and of itself was not regarded by Ms. Watkins as enough to warrant disciplinary action. Until we get to the weeks just before the deposition, when there's an allegation of a physical assault. At that point, Ms. Watkins has three choices. She can either seek to discipline the coworker, she can seek to discipline Ms. Benuzzi, or she had a third alternative. And the third alternative was for her to say, well, I can't do anything because there's pending litigation. And I think that the laws against retaliation are not designed to either prevent a principal from doing the job she is bound to do, nor do they act as an immunity for the person who has filed the charge. The timing of this event with respect regarding the depositions was driven completely by Ms. Benuzzi. She admits there was a physical confrontation, and that physical confrontation, which Ms. Watkins had nothing to do with initiating, occurred shortly before the deposition. And I think that the timing aspects run throughout this whole case, because most of the discipline that was initiated by Ms. Watkins was driven by reports from third parties, and there's no evidence in the record that these third parties had any knowledge that Ms. Benuzzi had filed a charge or were intended to be retaliatory. There's no evidence that Ms. Watkins, the first suspension came from a report from the other engineer, Mr. Vaughn. Another suspension resulted from a report from a student. These students were not involved in knowing about what was going on with respect to the charges. So I don't think there's
the age range at this school. It's a magnet school, right?
It's pre-kindergarten to eighth grade, so they were fairly young students. So I don't think that because the disputes that Ms. Benuzzi is trying to have the federal courts resolve were the ones between the people, the third parties, and Ms. Benuzzi. And they do not implicate or show any sort of animus towards Ms. Benuzzi's gender on the behalf of Ms. Watkins, because there's no evidence that she did not reasonably believe what she was being told. And I would like to quickly address the fact that there is no showing that by Ms. Benuzzi that other persons similarly situated were treated any more favorably. The only comparators that she points to is Mr. Vaughn, who was only there for a period of 2 years. And the only evidence that she provides that Mr. Vaughn engaged in similar activity to Ms. Benuzzi was an incident which led to the first suspension, where Mr. Vaughn accused Ms. Benuzzi of referring to her as a pussy. Basically, what Ms. Benuzzi does is sets forth two pieces of evidence which she claims show that Mr. Vaughn was engaging in the similar behavior. She reports that other students or other co-workers had heard Mr. Vaughn use similar language. However, there's no evidence that that this was reported to Ms. Watkins at the time that he allegedly does this, or actually allegedly did that. And the second piece of evidence that they set forth is contained in the brief at page 20, where they say a woman is unlikely to aim such a slur at a man. I find that argument quite ironic, because at the beginning of their brief, almost in the first page, they state, Benuzzi does not conform to conventional feminine gender stereotypes. So I find that argument rather ironic. And based upon the evidence which is before the court, I believe that the we would ask that the lower court's decision be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Trent. Ms. Siegel, your time had expired, but we had extensive questions, so you may have an additional 2 minutes.
I'd like to point out that there were numerous incidents in the record that were one-on-one. They didn't involve third parties. And perhaps one of the most important and one of the most dramatic is the situation where Ms. Benuzzi went up to speak with Ms. Watkins in her office after an evening in which there had been some dispute between her and Mr. Vaughn concerning overtime pay. She went in the office, and she was talking with the principal. And the principal, according to Ms. Benuzzi, told her that she needed to get out, that it was time for her to leave her position. And at that time, Ms. Benuzzi had an attack of stomach cramps. She bent over. She screamed in pain, and she had to leave. Now, Ms. Watkins tells a totally different story of what the nature of the conversation was. And Ms. Watkins says that the situation with the stomach attack was a contrivance, that in fact Ms. Benuzzi was malingering, that she immediately stood up when she left and she walked out of the room. And in the meantime, according to Ms. Watkins, people were coming and they were running because they thought that Ms. Watkins was in danger. But the assistant principal Anderson testified that, yes, Ms. Benuzzi was obviously in great pain and that she didn't stand up. She was bent over when she walked out the door. This is a one-on-one situation. This is a situation where we're not talking about third parties. We're talking about whether Ms. Watkins was telling the truth or Ms. Benuzzi was telling the truth. It's a central issue, and I think it's very important for the court to take notice that Ms. Watkins had prepared the fitness for duty form prior to the incident. So she had anticipated setting up a situation where she was going to, the inference arises, where she was going to hurl this accusation at Ms. Benuzzi and tell her she needed to get out of the school. And Ms. Benuzzi reacted. There are numerous incidents where there are one-on-one encounters between these two people. The first cautionary notices were like that. There weren't witnesses that were around. So I see that my time is up. But we're beyond the situation where it's third parties in good faith.
All right. Thank you, Sigurd. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court.